This is Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm Steve Taylor, your host to a horror anthology podcast with carefully curated original tales of terror each week. Our deepest rooted fears are brought to the forefront by a diverse cast of voice talent and masterfully eerie sound design. Make sure to check out Chilling Tales for Dark Nights wherever you get your podcasts. To subscribe now to always be the first to enjoy the horror show.
Pro Woche bis zu 50 Euro zusätzlich sparen. Mit der Netto Plus App. 10% Rabatt auf deinen Einkauf sichern. Dazu Payback-Punkte sammeln und sparen. Mach mehr Plus mit der Netto Plus App.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Stephen Marin and Margie Palm? Their story was featured in a Vanity Fair article in 2023. First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the kidnapping, then offer my analysis. Stephen Peter Marin was born on February 19, 1951, in Providence, Rhode Island. He lived in Florida when he was a teenager. Stephen dropped out of school, used drugs, and frequently engaged in criminal activity. He spent time in a juvenile detention facility after stealing several cars. When he was 14, he escaped. Stephen damaged three vehicles while driving a car he had stolen from his father. After being arrested and transported to a hospital, Stephen escaped again. The resulting police pursuit would see Stephen driving at 100 miles per hour. He was captured, tried as an adult, convicted, and sent to prison. Stephen did not have a good time in prison. He claimed that he was attacked many times. After being released from prison, Stephen continued committing crimes as he traveled across the country. He was arrested for drug possession, attacking a girlfriend, and killing that girlfriend's cat. In 1976, when Stephen was living in San Francisco, California, he attacked a 14-year-old girl, but eventually let her go. He moved to Las Vegas to escape the authorities. Stephen was pretty good at hiding. He had a number of different aliases. He found a job in Las Vegas and became married. Stephen then decided to launch a new career as a serial killer, an occupation he maintained for several years. The number of people that Stephen killed is not known, but the authorities believe he may have killed as many as 48 victims in the states of California, Nevada, Idaho, Washington, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Indiana, New York, and Texas. In 1981, Stephen encountered a woman named Margaret Mayfield Palm, who went by the name Margie. Let's take a look at her background. Margie grew up in El Paso, Texas. Her family was wealthy and well-known. Her father was killed in a motor vehicle collision when she was 11. Margie graduated from high school in 1969. She married a man named Bart in 1973 and moved to San Antonio, Texas. After attending a retreat in New Mexico, Margie developed an intense interest in Christianity. She felt connected to the universal nature of God's love. In 1977, Margie had a daughter. In 1979, she had a son. Her husband, Bart, worked as a real estate developer as Margie stayed home and cared for their children. Now moving to the timeline of the kidnapping. During the early morning hours of December 11, 1981, 30-year-old Stephen Marin shot two women as he was attempting to steal a car. One of those victims died as a result. Stephen made his way to the Sands Motel in San Antonio, where he was holding a woman hostage. The police sent a SWAT team to the motel, but Stephen climbed through a bathroom window. The police rescued the hostage, but Stephen managed to escape. Later that morning, Stephen was lurking in a Kmart parking lot in San Antonio, armed with a .38 caliber revolver and under the influence of amphetamines. 30-year-old Margie Palm was shopping at the Kmart that day. As she was walking back to her Chevrolet Suburban, Stephen approached her and threatened her with a revolver. He forced her inside the SUV. Stephen told Margie that he would kill her if she did not cooperate. He informed her that they would probably both die in a shootout with the police that day. Stephen noticed that Margie's SUV was full of wrapped Christmas presents. He complained about how he never received gifts like that when he was young and referred to Margie as a sheltered princess. Margie was understandably terrified by this encounter and started praying out loud. This caught Stephen by surprise. Even though Stephen had ordered Margie to sit on her hands, she put her hands on Stephen's head and ordered the evil spirits to exit his body. She demanded that they stop destroying his life and her life. She finished the exorcism by telling them to get out of her vehicle. That last step was important because the demons could have been confused about where they were permitted to go after leaving Stephen. The evil spirits may have left the SUV, but Stephen didn't. He started driving Margie's vehicle. She was trapped there with a killer. After spending some time in a parking lot having a deep conversation, Stephen drove to a 7-Eleven convenience store. He ordered Margie to purchase cigarettes, beer, and a newspaper. Stephen was on the front page of the newspaper. The headline read, "Accused Killer of 30, Guns Down 2 in San Antonio." This was not good news for Margie. She realized that she was in even more danger than she originally suspected. In the Vanity Fair article, Margie talked about how she contemplated telling the cashier at the store what was going on, but she was worried that Stephen might kill her and the cashier. During a 1996 interview on a religious TV show, Margie made it clear that she could have easily escaped when she was at the 7-Eleven. It's not clear which version is accurate, but I imagine it would have been easy for Margie to duck into the back room of the store and exit. Ultimately, Margie did not attempt to escape. From a phone booth outside the store, Stephen had Margie call her husband Bart and tell him everything was fine. Bart was not initially suspicious, but eventually became concerned and notified the police. Throughout the kidnapping journey, Stephen became more relaxed and introspective. He apologized for using expletives. Stephen explained how he had a son who he loved, but he hated himself and considered himself to be a fraud. Over the course of a few hours, Margie tried to convince Stephen that everyone could be forgiven. She asked Stephen if his sons committed crimes like he did, would Stephen forgive him? At one point, Stephen dramatically pulled the vehicle over and proclaimed, quote, "I'm sorry, Lord, for everything I've done. Please forgive me. I want to go to heaven," unquote. Sometime after this, he pulled into a rest area. He emptied the cartridges out of his .38 caliber revolver, putting them in Margie's purse. He promised her that he would never kill again. Stephen actually had 11 more cartridges in his pocket. Maybe he wasn't quite certain about that not killing part quite yet. Margie told Stephen about Kenneth Copeland, a well-known, intense, and somewhat frightening televangelist. He mostly preaches about two things, rebuking Satan and donating money to Kenneth Copeland. There is a sense that he thinks of Satan as a competitor. After hearing about Kenneth, Stephen became excited. He said that he would go to Kenneth Copeland's office in Fort Worth, Texas, and put the revolver on his desk. This was supposed to symbolize how Stephen was giving up violence. Another possibility is that Stephen thought Kenneth would immediately sell the gun, thereby getting rid of the evidence.
There are a lot of true crime podcasts out there, and I have 30 seconds to convince you why you should check out Crime Lines. Crime Lines is one of those shows that just lays it all out there, the backstory, the legal context, and details of cases you haven't heard before. If you hear about a true crime case and want to know what happened and why, you're my kind of listener. You can check out Crime Lines wherever you get your podcasts. That's Crime Lines, one word, and get ready to dive deep.
Hi, I'm Alicia.
And I'm Stacy.
And we make Trashy Divorces, everybody's favorite good podcast about bad relationships.
Looking for something true crimey without the gore or the body count?
We've been churning out funny, feisty, feminist episodes since 2019. So if you're looking to put some scandalous stories told well into your ears this summer, check out Trashy Divorces, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Trust us, we've covered someone you love.
Or someone you love to hate.
Stephen drove to a bus station in Kerrville, Texas. This is about an hour northwest of San Antonio. Margie purchased Stephen a ticket to Fort Worth. The bus was to stop in Austin, Texas before reaching Fort Worth. Stephen said to Margie, "You don't want to come with me?" She explained to Stephen how she had two children at home, and she encouraged him to get on the bus. Stephen hugged Margie, kissed her on the cheek, and gave her an earring before climbing onto the bus. Margie went back to her SUV and locked the doors. She could see Stephen waving from the window of the bus as it pulled away. At this point, Margie drove home to San Antonio. The police arrived at her residence right after she did because her husband had called them. Margie was transported to the police station, where she lied about Stephen's whereabouts. She told them that she left him at the Kmart. After being dropped off at home, Margie told her husband the truth. He, in turn, called the police. By this time, Stephen was at a bus station in Austin, ostensibly waiting for the next leg of his journey to Fort Worth. Officers descended on the bus station and arrested Stephen without incident. He was just sitting there reading a book of scriptures that Margie had given to him. The revolver was still in his pocket. It was not loaded. Stephen was charged with the murder that he committed right before kidnapping Margie. He pleaded guilty in April 1982. He told the judge, "The only plea bargaining I've done, Your Honor, is with my Lord." At sentencing, Stephen's defense was that he had found Jesus. The jury believed him, but still sentenced him to death. Stephen received another death sentence for strangling a 21-year-old woman in Corpus Christi. He was extradited to Colorado in 1984 to stand trial for a 1981 homicide. Officers found that Stephen was hiding a Texas driver's license, $50 in cash, a list of names and addresses, as well as razor blades in his shoes. He claimed that he had collected those items for personal protection. One could appreciate how razor blades and maybe even money could be used defensively, but how would the other items discourage jailhouse attackers? I can picture a situation where inmates are getting ready to punch Stephen. He pulls out the driver's license and they're like, "Well, anyone who can drive is good in our book." Later, Stephen claimed his behavior represented a momentary lapse of faith. Stephen was found guilty and was awarded with death sentence number 3. He refused to file any appeals in any of his cases. He did not want a new trial and did not do anything else that would delay his execution. As Stephen was waiting to die, he called Margie from prison and wrote her letters, including Christmas cards. Stephen and Margie developed what has been referred to as a friendship. During his time in prison, Margie visited Stephen about 15 times. Just after midnight on March 13, 1985, it was time for Stephen to die. He joked with the prison guards, asking them if they would rather go fishing. They were more interested in shooting fish in a barrel, but it would be harder than they thought. Stephen was tortured in the execution chamber of the Texas prison for about 40 minutes as technicians repeatedly stabbed him with needles trying to find a suitable vein. He had been an intravenous substance user, which damaged his veins. When the workers were finally ready to kill him, Stephen offered many last words, mostly about religion. The warden actually had to stop him from talking to move on with the grisly task at hand. I don't know what the warden said. Perhaps it was something like, "Stephen, you seem eager to meet God. As it turns out, we can make that happen right now." Stephen Marin was executed at 12:55 a.m. He was 34 years old. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts in a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number 1. Stephen had a terrible history of mistreatment, including his time in prison when he was in his mid-teens. He murdered dozens of people and committed many other crimes during his life. Stephen was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, which is characterized by impulsivity, irresponsibility, and a tendency to commit crimes. One mental health clinician who evaluated Stephen described him as friendly, interesting, and rather charming. Stephen was highly manipulative. He was very good at convincing people that he was not a dangerous person. Item number 2. During the kidnapping, when Stephen was in Margie's Chevrolet Suburban, she had a tape from Kenneth Copeland, in the stereo. Stephen ejected this tape and tried to find something more to his liking. Eventually, Stephen found a tape by Christopher Cross containing a famous song titled Ride Like the Wind. Stephen was joyful and talked about how it was his favorite song. The song is about someone who is on the run and trying to remain free. One line goes, I was born the son of a lawless man, always spoke my mind with a gun in my hand. Talk about finding the right song for the moment. Stephen was lucky in that regard. Considering how things worked out, I think that Cyndi Lauper's True Colors would have been good too, but it was not released until 1986. Item number 3. After getting away from Stephen and learning that he was a serial killer, Margie felt as though she had been manipulated by him. She later came to believe that he may have really changed and said, quote, I really did become friends with the guy, unquote. Stephen's communications with Margie, in the form of calls and letters, mostly revolved around religion. But he also mentioned a few other things which were curious. For example, Stephen implied that he could be a threat to Margie's marriage, like he felt guilty about getting between her and her husband. Stephen claimed that he was born again, but he did not take ownership of his other crimes. He said, quote, I have not committed a quarter of the crimes which I have been accused of, unquote. Stephen was also highly interested in selling a book about his life, as well as the movie rights. Margie visited Stephen the day before he was executed. He said that he was ready to die and felt good. Stephen apologized to Margie by saying, quote, I'm sorry for kidnapping you, but not really. I'm glad we met because my life changed. I'm not the same person I was before, unquote. Despite being friends with Margie, or pretending to be, Margie always believed that Stephen needed to be in prison for life, no matter what. She recognized that he was permanently dangerous. Now moving to the final item, number 4. Many of Stephen's victims are not convinced that he changed. Did Stephen actually become a different person? This is just a theory, my opinion. I think that Stephen did not really change. Rather, he simply found another way to express his narcissism. He modified his tactics. Stephen may have been tired of his lifestyle. Activities like murder, assault, stealing, and drug use can make a perpetrator weary. Maybe the criminal activities no longer satisfied his needs. Finding religion and repenting was his way of stepping off an exhausting crime roller coaster. More importantly, it allowed him to attract attention and tell his story. Stephen loved to talk about himself and about how he was going to heaven. He did that right up until the moment he was executed. I think that Stephen knew that he was going to be caught and executed at some point. He wanted to be remembered as someone who had been redeemed. He wanted his story to be positive, or as positive as it could be with the murder part. During the kidnapping, Margie's willingness to listen to him, her empathy, and her belief that he could change connected with his narcissism. It offered him another path, one that just happened to save Margie's life. That wasn't something that Stephen necessarily cared about. It was just the way things worked out. Stephen may have believed that Margie could have loved him romantically under different circumstances, like when he talked about how he could be interfering with her marriage. He was getting his needs met in that relationship. Margie offered Stephen a way to make sense of his death. She convinced him that he would live forever in peace and joy. Essentially, he would be able to beat the system. This is something that strongly appealed to Stephen. Considering that Stephen was facing death, he was more than happy to believe.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.